Welcome to the program. This week, we saw the release of some 92,000 reports that make up a six-year archive of classified military documents that offer a raw picture of the war in Afghanistan. While many have said these reports are but punctuation to that which we already knew, they certainly paint a portrait far more damaging than anything we've heard thus far from the administration or the American military. Additionally, the documents were released through the controversial website WikiLeaks and released exclusively to the New York Times, the Guardian of London, and Der Spiegel in Germany. One of the principal journalists that has been part of the New York Times team on this story is our guest this morning, Eric Schmidt. Eric Schmidt covers the war on terrorism for the New York Times. He's a former Pentagon correspondent for the Times, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. It is my pleasure to welcome him this morning to talk about his series of New York Times articles dealing with Inside the Fog of War, reports from the ground in Afghanistan. Eric Schmidt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Pleasure to have you here. First of all, I want to talk just for a bit about process and how all of these documents came to the New York Times from WikiLeaks. How did this process work?
Well, WikiLeaks had contacted, had been in contact with The Guardian. He mentioned one of the two other European news organizations that were involved. WikiLeaks also wanted to have an American publication involved in this. So the New York Times was contacted. I was sent over to London to take an initial look at the data. We had access to the data from the WikiLeaks database, and I determined it was certainly worthwhile pursuing and enlisted help from my colleagues in New York. A number of my colleagues came in from assignments overseas who are experts in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the intelligence community, as well as some very able colleagues who do computer-assisted reporting for us in New York, so we could go through the voluminous documents, as you mentioned.
It is interesting that even though all of this information, once it was out there, traveled at internet speed, it is a kind of reaffirmation of the importance of mainstream journalism, of long-form narrative reporting, and all the vetting that goes into the work that journalists at places like the New York Times do.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, if all this information had just been dumped out, it had been like marbles rolling around on the floor, it would have been very difficult, given the competitive pressures we're all under, to really do, I think, a thorough job with the type of careful vetting that we were able to do in the 4 weeks or so that we had to assess this information. So I think in that sense, the New York Times did what it does best, and that is apply kind of journalistic standards and reached out to outside experts once we had a feel for what this material was to get their assessment of what this was and wasn't. And then also in the very end, consulted the White House, the CIA, and the military itself to ensure there wasn't going to be any information released that could jeopardize ongoing operations or put any American or Afghan officials in harm's way.
Given that the administration has already said that it wishes that all of this classified information had not been out there, how were the decisions made with respect to what would and would not be redacted?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to look at is to see, is there anything in here that could actually harm any individual, any American soldier, or in this case, more likely be Afghan informants or individuals in Afghanistan who came forward to work with the United States, who could be targeted by the Taliban should their identities be disclosed. In addition to that, there obviously, in any kind of these documents, even the relatively low-level classification that these had, there could be sources and methods that would be used, that is, things the military, the intelligence community is using now that they wouldn't necessarily want disclosed, any kind of sensitive targeting information, things like that. So we went through this information and tried to err on the side of caution, redacting it. If you go to our website, you'll notice in some of the incident reports, the samples of which we posted on our website, They've clearly been, certain things have been redacted. I don't think that takes away from the power of these individual stories and incident reports, but I think it does provide some level of protection.
Talk a little about what these reports were, the samples, the things that are on the examples that are on the website. Talk about them as intelligence summaries, incident reports, various other similar kinds of things. What were they?
These are basically raw intelligence reports, incident reports, kind of the first level reporting of a firefight, of a drone attack, of a commando raid, oftentimes minutes of meetings between Afghan, Pakistan, and American officials, and so in some cases, these are they're often just snapshots, if you will. These aren't finished assessments by any means. There's been some references to these are the next Pentagon Papers. And I don't think that's quite accurate. The Pentagon Papers, of course, were finished assessments of the war in Vietnam. These are very much the raw material from which those larger, sometimes more highly classified assessments are made. So this is a starting point. That's why it was so important to kind of try and cull together, look at this, look at the sources of information here. I think we all felt that the reports themselves were authentic, but the information in the reports, the credibility of that information varied widely from information that we felt pretty comfortable with to stuff that was just kind of off the wall and crazy and you could discard just on the face of it.
But in its totality, it gives a pretty accurate, arguably, snapshot of what was going on in this period that it covers from 2004 to 2009.
Absolutely, and that, I think, is the real power of these documents. When you put them all together, while many of the themes have been reported on, certainly by the New York Times and some other news organizations, it's almost as if we've been reporting kind of on the highs and the lows. And this gives an amazing amount of new textured detail, kind of the day-to-day life of a soldier on the ground in Afghanistan, but also what it's like to be a civilian, an Afghan civilian, and what they face day in, day out, the intimidation that they face from the Taliban, and unfortunately just the random acts of violence that are cropping up here and there that weren't necessarily going to be reported in the daily newspaper or television, but certainly come through in the individual stories that these documents tell.
Do we get a sense of how the situation in Afghanistan deteriorated from the initial success in the fall of 2001 and early 2002 to really the rise again of the insurgency and through this 5-6 year period, the Taliban, in fact, becoming stronger than at any point since 2001?
I think so. I mean, these documents start in January of 2004. When it's still relatively calm in Afghanistan. Things are starting to pick up within a year or two there, and certainly by the end of the documents period, which is December of 2009, the end of the first year of the Obama administration, it's clear just in the anecdotal reporting of IED attacks, of ambushes, of threats coming against not only Americans, but more likely against Afghans, that the level of violence is on the rise, the ability of the Taliban to organize in oftentimes a very sophisticated way for a guerrilla operation becomes quite clear. And the frustration also comes through, I think, in the voices, however brief they may be, in some of these summary narratives from American officials and soldiers of the frustration they feel in going up against this kind of enemy and the frustration they often feel in dealing with their ostensible allies on the ground, the Afghan security forces, but even more so the Pakistani spy service, the so-called ISI, in these reports.
One of the things that's particularly interesting and ironic is that we look back to 2001 and we see how relatively easy it was to have that initial success in Afghanistan in defeating the Taliban. But as the Taliban comes back and as these reports indicate through this 5-6 year period, they became not only stronger, but more clever, and in so many ways smarter as the time went on.
That's right, and it's a classic case of a guerrilla campaign gaining momentum, understanding their enemy better, and of a very much of an under-resourced American-led campaign in Afghanistan, not making the adjustments as quickly and not having the resources to do so. It's not quite apparent in many of these documents, but clearly the resources have been shifted away from Afghanistan to Iraq during this time period when the fighting there and the insurgency there is at its peak. And it's not until, say, late 2008 and 2009 that you get a sense that finally attention again is being refocused on Afghanistan, both in the field there as well as back in Washington.
And in fact, in one of the stories on Sunday or Monday, talks about the fact that we shouldn't forget that this was relegated to a second-class war for a long time.
Absolutely, and that comes through time and time again of how under-resourced the troops are in the field. They don't have the assets. You have some absolutely riveting stories of American outposts, these isolated combat outposts in the eastern part of Afghanistan, the mountains, being overwhelmed or nearly overwhelmed and nearly overrun by Taliban attacks, and how it takes much longer than you would think to get assistance, whether it be in the form of medevac helicopters or attack helicopters, basically general reinforcements to these small outposts. And you have, again, just this gripping minute by minute, almost second by second account coming in from the commanders, and they're basically screaming for help and screaming that the enemy is inside the wire, meaning inside the lines, and it may be within minutes they may be forced to go into hand-to-hand combat. So you have that kind of fine-grained detail that gives you a sense of what's going on in some of these far-flung outposts in the wilds of Afghanistan.
And the idea of using American military equipment, American trucks, for suicide bombs and even donning the uniforms in some cases of the Afghan military.
Right, and it just goes to show both that it is a very cunning enemy that's able to take advantage of these things, whether it's with captured arms or buying them off the black market and turning against the Afghan forces and their American allies in many cases. And again, classic guerrilla-style insurgency.
One of the other unique things is these heat-seeking missiles, these Stinger missiles, which we provided to the Afghanis, which were used so effectively against the Soviets, are now being turned on us.
That's right. This is for the first time there indicate reports of these kind of missiles. Of course, this was a great fear when the United States went into Afghanistan that some of these missiles left over from the conflict with the Soviets, the missiles, as you said, that the U.S. had supplied to the Mujahideen at that time would come back to haunt us. There were very aggressive campaigns by the CIA and the military to buy these things back. And it looked up until these reports came out that there really had not been any confirmed reports of some of these missiles. These reports, while still not completely definitive now, seem to point to at least a small number of these type of things. Again, I wouldn't want to overstate the threat of these missiles, but it does appear that from the evidence emerging from these reports that there are at least a small number of cases where the Taliban have been able to use these weapons.
What does it mean that the CIA was effectively running the Afghani Secret Service during this period of time between 2001 and 2008?
Well, this is similar to what happened in Iraq, in that basically is after the Taliban government is pushed out, along with Al-Qaeda, the United States is helping the fledgling Afghan government rebuild itself. And in this process, the CIA takes it, just as the military is trying to kind of rebuild and retrain an army and a national police force, the CIA is doing the same thing with the new Afghan intelligence service. For several years, the CIA is basically underwriting the cost of this new service, and obviously would have great influence over the top officials and who's hired and those kind of things. Again, so the CIA is trying to put its stamp on this service, and as you indicated, one of the stories talks about the intelligence chief lamenting the fact that he's now going to be more on his own in terms of funding, and it actually comes kind of hat in hand to the Americans for some very basic supplies as well.
Another aspect of this story, you touched on it a moment ago, that has certainly got a lot of attention this week and is not surprising, but yet the totality of it is somehow so powerful, and that is the role of the Pakistani ICS, the Pakistani Secret Police.
Yes, it's the spy agency, and this has been a relationship that's long been a contentious one with the United States. In many ways, of course, the United States is very reliant on the ISI, the spy service, for help in tracking down Al-Qaeda elements that are using the safe havens of Pakistan to carry out their plot and carry out their attacks, along with other militant groups. So on the one hand, you have a situation where the United States is paying Pakistan over $1 billion a year, basically to finance the cost of some 150,000 troops that are along the border carrying out essentially counterterrorism operations. And at the same time, the spy agency, which is a part of the military, is very clearly involved in supporting insurgent groups such as the Afghan Taliban that are carrying out attacks inside of Afghanistan against American and other allied forces. So this is a part of the very complicated relationship that the U.S. and Pakistan have. American officials in both the Bush and now the Obama administrations have been pressuring Pakistanis to sever these ties. But the problem is, Pakistan is going to do what it's in its natural national interests. They fear that come next July, when President Obama has said the United States will begin withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, they fear that the United States, just as they did after the end of the Soviet wars will leave Pakistan kind of handling the brunt of the consequences of any kind of troop withdrawal. So they're already, you know, holding on to some of their proxy groups, such as the Taliban, such as the so-called Haqqani network, that operate in Afghanistan for basically their long-term interests.
These reports, as we've talked about, go through 2009 and don't include the period from the time that the president decided to add another 30,000, 40,000 troops to Afghanistan and step up the insurgent effort and most recently bring in General Petraeus. Is there any reason to think that doing these things is going to dramatically or has dramatically changed the situation on the ground?
Well, again, you can, I think certainly General Petraeus following on General McChrystal is a very able officer. I mean, I think the military certainly has plans in place where they feel they can ultimately bring much of the insurgency under some type of control. I think one of the greater issues and greater problems they're facing is what happens next in terms of the governance on the ground, the civilian aspect, and just relying on the Afghan civilian government to provide the support they need to come in and provide the economic assistance, the governance that these places need. And so far, that just hasn't happened. So even if the American military does its job in clearing and reducing some of the threat from these insurgents, which in itself is a very tall order under the deadline that Petraeus faces, it's still very unclear whether the Afghans themselves will step up, both in terms of building their security forces, helping to build an economy, but even more important, coming up with a set of governance that the Afghan people trust, that's not corrupt, that can carry forward.
Looking at this situation through 2009, it becomes so much easier, I suppose, in some ways, and clearer to understand why Obama made the decisions he made with regard to stepping up the efforts in Afghanistan.
Well, clearly it shows that, again, that during the years of the Bush administration, the campaign in Afghanistan was under-resourced. There clearly weren't enough troops to deal with the growing threat from the Taliban. The Taliban was spreading throughout the country, but also there was really just not the kind of broader support to face a counterinsurgency. The military campaign is only one part of a counterinsurgency. You have to develop credible and trusted civilian leaders who the people have faith in. You need economic programs, you need jobs and things such that, again, we'll get the economy, such as it is in Afghanistan, you know, on the mend. And so all these things taken together are a part of and make up President Obama's larger plan. You know, there's still just many, many questions now whether this plan, even he's articulated it, can actually succeed on the ground.
There's very little good news in all of these documents and in all of this report. Some of it, though, is in the work of this Task Force 373, which did have some success. Talk a bit about that.
Yes, this is one of the many task forces that operate from the military Special Operations Command, specifically the Joint Special Operations Command. These are the so-called Delta Force and Navy SEALs that are carrying out what are called capture and kill missions. Their targets are usually the senior militant leaders, Taliban leaders in Afghanistan, and we got a little bit of a glimpse of these units' missions on the ground in Afghanistan as they go after some of these senior leaders and try and reduce their effectiveness, and in doing so, again, try and push some of these militant groups to the bargaining table and away from the idea that they're winning on the ground.
Has there been a reaction from General Petraeus and his people yet to this?
You know, there hasn't been any specific reaction that I'm aware of from Petraeus. His spokesmen have kind of referred back to his testimony here in the Senate from about a month ago, acknowledging the challenges that he and his sub-commanders face on the ground, and also pointing out the fact that the resources that they've requested and they're now coming forward really won't be in place and complete until the end of August. So the full 30,000 or so troops that are expected to come will not be in place by then. He has recognized the challenges that are underway. He's already, it looks to be kind of one, you know, kind of minor victory, and that is the American military has been pressing to develop what are called local defense forces in and through communities around Afghanistan. They don't like them to be called militias because that has smacks of warlordism and all, which has of course dominated Afghanistan through the decades and all. But these would be individual self-defense units that would work with the various national Afghan police and army units to try and bring security to their individual communities, which right now is, you know, one of the basic and fundamental goals of the American and Afghans on the ground.
And what pressure, if any, can we bring to bear on Pakistan to try and deal with that aspect of the problem?
Well, I think the Americans have concluded that berating them in public doesn't do any good and maybe be counterproductive. So I think it's a constant stream of visitors. Admiral Michael Mullen was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was just there a few days ago. There's a constant parade of civilian and military officials who are going through Pakistan to kind of reinforce what the U.S. national goals are in terms of counterterrorism and trying to work with the Pakistanis so they can get the American goals in sync with the Pakistani goals. They're not always in line in this regard. The United States has made a great effort in not only providing money and equipment, but also training to some of the Pakistani army units, as well as their paramilitary border force that are conducting many of the operations right now. So it's rather than one big bang, if you will, it's just kind of a steady, constant pressure on them to try and do more. And in fact, the Pakistanis have done a lot more in the past year. I think if you looked at the operations they've had in Waziristan and other areas along the border, and asked anybody a year ago, to predict what they had done all up to this point, I think a lot of people would be surprised. But there's still some of the hardest areas to clear and to deal with are still yet to come, and those are ones the Americans continue to press on.
And of course, one of the things that is not entirely clear from all of these documents is the degree to which there is top-down control in the Pakistani military, and whether or not there are in fact rogue elements.
That's right. I mean, the ISI, the spy agency, is a vast, sprawling organization with very, very various different components. And while it's quite hierarchical, so it's hard to believe that the senior-most leadership isn't aware, at least tacitly, of what's going on. Many of their operations do seem to be carried out by whether you call them rogue or retired officers with connections to some of these groups who are kind of given a wink and a nod to continue doing what they're doing. It's very murky and hard to kind of pin down and get very specific evidence of direct complicity between the spy agency and some of these groups.
You wrote Monday about the political aspect of this in terms of how the administration was responding. Talk a little bit about that, because the response has been interesting in that it's been, okay, so what, kind of different than we might have expected had this come out during the Bush administration, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the general reaction, I think, of many lawmakers has been, particularly those that support the war, was that there's not a whole lot new here. Yes, there's new details and particularly on the Pakistan angle, kind of new texture to what we've learned, but no new great revelations. That said, however, I think many in the public aren't necessarily aware of these problems in their totality, and particularly as you read through some of the individual stories. So I think is public sentiment toward the war has been growing under greater question. I think this lands at a time where it could fuel some of the momentum against the war, both in Congress and the public in general. But it's going to be hard. It's kind of tricky to see how this may break in the end.
The corollary of that, of course, is that it also makes us realize what happened when this war was undersourced.
That's right. I mean, there's always the question if this had been handled more aggressively from the beginning, going all the way back until into early 2002, when the shift of resources really started happening dramatically, if the campaign against not just the Taliban but certainly against Al Qaeda, as Al Qaeda fled across the border into Pakistan, had that all been pursued more aggressively, and the shift toward Iraq had not happened, would we be sitting in the position we are today? Question of course can't be answered, but certainly raises some interesting issues to explore.
Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome, Jeff. Good
luck. Thank you.